Most business podcasts today focus on the 1%, the nationally known larger-than-life personalities, entrepreneurs, and celebrities with interesting business stories. Business Exit Stories shares the stories of the other 99% of unheralded entrepreneurs that own successful companies in manufacturing, retail, logistics, telecommunications, construction, food service, and in every imaginable type of business in every state and city around the country. These are the stories told by the deal makers that facilitate exits. These are the mergers and acquisition specialists, business brokerages, financial and wealth planners, CPAs, appraisers, and attorneys. By listening to their stories, you'll learn what the entrepreneurs and business owners they represent did right and what they did wrong when it comes to exiting their business through a sale or a merger. In fact, you'll not only learn how they avoided disastrous exits, but how they positioned their companies for an out-of-the-ballpark home run when they exited their business. And here's your host, Marvin L. Storm.
Today on the Business Exit Stories podcast, we are talking to Mark Doust. Mark is based in Minnesota and is with Quiet Light Brokerage, a specialist in SaaS, or otherwise known as software as a service, and in the e-commerce business niche. Today on the podcast, Mark shares a story about a transaction that was a week away from closing with a highly qualified buyer when a key vendor notified the seller that they were unilaterally terminating their long-standing business relationship and that the seller had 48 hours to remove all of their products from their e-commerce website, including all logos and product references. Mark shares how devastating this was to both the buyer and the seller. On this episode of the podcast, you will learn how the seller sprang into action and what he did to salvage the situation and how he turned this into be a blessing in disguise. Next, Mark shares how accrual accounting versus cash accounting can actually increase business valuation, sometimes more than doubling the enterprise value of a business. In another transaction, Mark shares how documentation and organization reduces the perception of risk. Most of the time, buyers don't know what they don't know, and this often creates risk in the buyer's mind. This is important because real or perceived risk deflates the valuation of a business. Then Mark shares how a client of his mitigated this issue almost entirely and had buyers lined up to purchase the business. Finally, Mark shares details about a transaction of a religious dating website where the business owner was ready to sell. The owner had a number in mind that he wanted to get for his business, but that number was nearly double what the business was actually worth. Mark outlines how the seller was able to get very close to his exit price by following a process to create value. This is Marvin Storm with the Business Exit Stories podcast. We're here today with Mark Doust. And Mark, would you take a few minutes and introduce yourself to our audience here?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks, first of all, for having me on, Marvin. I really appreciate it. As you said, my name is Mark. I'm the founder of Quiet Light Brokerage. We've started the company in 2007, focusing primarily on exits in the online space. Now, back then, we were just talking about websites. People that had oftentimes a side hustle where they had built a website and it started to generate some money and they were looking to either invest in it more fully or exit it, which was where we would come in. But today, our service really encompasses much larger and more complex internet-based businesses, everything from SaaS, which would be software as a service businesses, content sites, to Amazon and e-commerce and product-based businesses. Our team is upwards of 10 advisors at this point, and one of the main differences with us is that everyone that works with Quiet Light Brokerage, we're all entrepreneurs, right? So we've all bought, sold, and started our own internet-based companies. Many of us have double-digit acquisitions on our resumes. I personally don't. I'm in the single digits still, but many of us have double-digit exits as well. So a lot of experience in this whole space of what you like to talk about on your podcast.
All right, cool. Mark, why don't you take a few minutes, if you could, and share a couple of real challenging stories that may have had a good exit or maybe didn't even close, and share some of the details of those transactions so our audience here can get a feel for some of the challenges that will come up in exiting a business.
Yeah, you know, I like to tell our advisors, especially when they're going through a difficult transaction, that the number of transactions over the past, 14 years or so that I can count on, that have gone extremely well, I can count on probably two hands, right? Every deal has its hiccups. Every deal has its struggles and its challenges. It's just the nature of selling a complex asset. Is that you're going to deal with some challenges every now and then. One story that particularly comes to mind is a transaction that I closed, I want to say it was 3 years ago. Wasn't a particularly large deal. This was a six-figure transaction. But the seller was great to work with. I loved working with the seller. He was super organized and had everything lined up and documented really well. And it's not really a big surprise. He was an accountant by trade. He wasn't practicing an accountancy. He didn't have a practice opened up at that time. But he was an accountant by trade. What he really enjoyed doing with his businesses or businesses that he would acquire is he would take a business that was somewhat messy or maybe not optimized, and he would identify the areas where he could optimize that business and simplify it, more importantly, right? So if you were to take a look at his income statements from when he acquired a business to when he would flip it and sell it, they would actually become shorter and simpler and easier to understand. He was great at applying the Pareto principle of the 80-20, right? Where we're not going to focus on those elements that aren't really producing much. We're going to really double down on those elements that are doing really well. And we're going to keep things as simple and as straightforward and as encapsulated as possible. So before he retained me to sell this particular transaction, which I want to tell the story of, he had acquired a business that was selling physical products. And I can't get into all the details of what they were selling, but we can say it was a sanitary product that would have been used very heavily in say daycares. This wasn't a consumable good. This was a durable good that would be used. It was one of the elements was like a mobile washing station to wash hands, you know, for the kids or even for the caretakers there. But he had a variety of products that were all sort of focused in on this daycare, elementary school, kind of young childcare sort of space. The business itself was comprised of multiple websites, as is often the case with e-commerce businesses. One of the websites was doing really well. The other businesses were doing okay to not good.
When you say, just for clarification purposes, when you say multiple websites, this means that one website would have products they would sell in the sanitary space and another website would have a different line of products they would sell. Is that how that worked?
Yeah, it's just a same niche, but a little bit different spin on the products, right? And maybe the type of product. If we're thinking about it like a car, you can say, oh, I operate websites in the auto parts space, but maybe you're really specializing in brakes on one website, whereas the other one you're focusing on finishing products for the car, right? So same space, a little bit of a different niche, or maybe sub niche would be the way to describe it.
Okay, well, that helps a lot.
So we had a little bit of complexity with the sale in that as much as he simplified the business, we did have these multiple properties that we had to overcome. But honestly, he did a great job overall of creating a compelling package of these businesses to show how they all work together very well. And so it wasn't really a big surprise that we found a buyer within a few months of listing the business.
So how long did he operate this business before he sold it?
I want to say it was a little over 2 years. It wasn't a terribly long period of time. But, you know, this also wasn't this wasn't the biggest business he was operating in. And he was ready to make another investment that was more sizable in another business. He brought this about as far as he wanted to take it. Again, really cleaning it up, getting rid of some of the fluff, you know, advertising that wasn't working well, products that just didn't make sense to have on the sites, kind of narrowing down the focus to be a little bit simpler to run. His whole thesis was that there is an appeal to buying a business that's easy to run and kicks off a good amount of cash, right? So take a business that might be taking 40 hours a week to run and simplify it down to a business that takes 12 to 15 hours per week to run. And that becomes a very appealing acquisition target. And he had done this a few times before successfully as well. So pretty skilled in this area. And you know, true to form, we did find a buyer despite some of the complexities with the multiple sites. And everything was going along very smoothly. It was one of those rare transactions where we didn't really run into any issues. During our due diligence phase, right, there's a lot of elements that are inspected in due diligence that are sensitive. Sometimes a buyer might want to speak to existing customers to see, you know, are they satisfied with the product, or if it's a service-based business, definitely that would be the case. For a SaaS business, a buyer might want to look at the source code, which is pretty sensitive. And with e-commerce businesses, at some point, a buyer wants to speak with their vendors, the primary people they're ordering products from. This is an important step because we need to ensure that that buyer is going to get the same or similar terms that the existing seller currently has. So, for example, if the seller has, say, net 60 or even net 90 payment terms, that really helps with cash flow. And a buyer is going to want to make sure they get those same terms. Or if they're getting favorable pricing or are in a certain grandfathered in pricing range, you're going to want to make sure that you get that those same or similar terms so that your profitability doesn't suffer from getting less favorable terms. So something like that, where we're talking to a vendor, is often put off until one of the last items in due diligence, simply because talking to vendors and letting them know that the business is for sale is a little bit more sensitive. And sellers also don't like to disclose necessarily where they're getting their product from and maybe all the details behind that.
And the reason they do that is primarily if the deal doesn't close, they haven't disclosed all their proprietary information.
Exactly. You know, ideally, no one is ever going to use that information against you or to set up a competing business, but there's always that threat. And so why disclose it if you don't have to? If the deal's going to fall apart based off the financials, let's have it fall apart there, right? That's sort of the reasoning that we have by pushing that off to the last minute. In all the years that I've been doing this, we've run into vendor issues from time to time, which are fairly easy to overcome. So maybe a vendor will say, well, I can't offer these terms, or I want to have this new stipulation. And they're usually pretty minor requests that we can overcome pretty quickly. This was a completely different story. No one saw this coming, happened out of left field. My client reached out to his vendor and said, hey, great news. I'm moving on. I have a new owner coming into the business that is going to be taking it over. I'd like to make that introduction to you so that we can continue doing business with you. And something happened, we don't know what, where that vendor replied back and said, no. He said, I'm not doing this. In fact, we have made a determination in-house that we are no longer going to do business with you. You have 48 hours to discontinue our products on your website and to take all logos and mentions of our business off of your website.
So out of the left field, the vendor that had primarily all of this e-commerce business basically said, no, we're not going to do business with you anymore, or the new buyer.
Right. You know, it's one thing for a vendor to say, no, we will not do business under these terms with a new buyer. We've run into a situation before where a vendor says, look, this previous business was grandfathered in, but we can't take on new contracts, right? And that, you know, that might happen. We can usually overcome this. This was, not only are we not going to work with the person buying your business, we're done with you.
Holy smokes. That's a big surprise, huh?
It was an awful surprise. It was made even more awful by virtue of the fact that, you know, this was not a large business. So they didn't have a large number of vendors that they were working with. This vendor represented the vast majority of revenues and products on this site. The client was really representing their brand and pretty much their, it wasn't exclusive, but it was for all intents and purposes exclusive. And so this was catastrophic. I mean, this was, you know, deal should be broken and dead, but.
So what happened?
Well, the seller kept his head cool, and the more importantly, the buyer kept their heads cool as well. And fortunately, the seller had already made relationships with a few other competing vendors just in case something like this would have happened in the future, and was able to reach out to their top competitor and get their products up on his website within 24 hours. He was able to turn around completely within a very short amount of time, get this new product up on the website. The buyer agreed to putting off closing rather than canceling, putting off closing for a few weeks so that we could assess what impact this would have on sales. We did make a pretty minor price adjustment downward because of this disruption. I think it came in just under 15% of the purchase price.
So you're talking about the price adjustment, not on the products, but on the sales price.
Right, on the acquisition. Obviously, you know, this introduced a level of uncertainty, which everybody could understand. And so the seller was more than amenable to making some price concession there. But we decided just to push the closing back and to play it out. You know, and it's a really good thing. The lesson and the takeaway here is that vendor stability and looking for single points of failure in your business is really crucial. It would have been great had my client implemented competing vendors' products from a much earlier date, right? That would have been a good thing to do. But he didn't do that. What he did do was he had a backup plan in place. And when it came time to use that backup plan, it worked flawlessly. Revenues did not dip. He was able to show over a period of a few weeks that the clients actually enjoyed this new product. And he said in some ways, he thinks it may have been a blessing in disguise because he thinks that the other products, after reviewing them a bit more closely, may have been a better quality product. The pricing was a little bit higher, which is why he didn't implement it previously. But at the end of the day, it ended up working out for everybody involved. The buyer ended up getting a slight discount, which is great for them. My client was able to sell the business, and they were able to go on their merry way. But obviously, boy, that was a difficult phone call when I heard that the vendor completely flipped out.
I would say so. That would have been a really tense conversation, especially when it comes out of the blue. So I guess the big takeaway here, Mark, is that you have relationships in place in advance. So if the unexpected happens, you have a plan B. And if he had not had a plan B, my guess is that too much time would have passed between finding another vendor and getting those products up on the website, that revenues would have fallen, and the deal would probably have come unwrapped, and the business could have really taken a big hit, and it would have been a long time before he'd been able to get that business sales volume back up.
Yeah, and you know, the deal probably would have fallen apart, and we most likely would have needed to wait a few months because there would have been a temporary dip in sales, right? Which would have definitely hurt the valuation on multiple fronts. So having that backup plan, you're right, absolutely right, Marvin. The lesson here is to identify those single points of failure in your business and at a bare minimum, at least have the relationship open and available to you should you need to walk through that door. You know, at the end of the day, the buyer got a business with a more stable vendor where they obviously the vendor they were working on gave them decent pricing, but was not stable and was not a good relationship at the end of the day. So it did work out. But, you know, look at your business, identify where the potential weak points are, and get a backup plan in place.
All right, cool. Well, why don't we go on to another transaction here that had its challenges? Why don't you share another deal with us?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a transaction I actually closed last year, and it was one of the more difficult transactions that I've ever closed, primarily because it just seemed like every step of the way, we ran into issues.
What kind of business was it?
The business was selling a pest repellent. It wasn't pesticide. But for example, one of the products they sold was bird scare tape. So if you're having problems with birds congregating, maybe on your patio or something, or if you have you know, maybe a predatory pest, they would sell products that would deter those pests. But like the bird repellent tape was like this reflective tape that would scare birds away from that area. So they were selling these products, I want to say for 4 or 5 years, primarily on Amazon. The owner themselves was a serial entrepreneur who had a couple of Amazon businesses that he was running on the side. He was also in the entertainment industry. And wanted to pursue that a bit more and also pursue some of his other side projects. So looked at where this business was going. It was growing. It was doing well. But it was also taking up more and more of his time. So he decided to move on from it and to sell it and retained us to help him go through that process. So challenge number one, and again, there was a lot of challenges with this business. Challenge number one were his books. I'm sure anyone that's listened to your podcast, Marvin, hears people talk about the importance of having clean books. The second thing that I would say is you should have your books at least entered in whatever system you're using on accrual basis and not on cash basis. You can still file your taxes on cash basis. That's up to your tax accountant, but you should be recording your numbers on accrual basis.
Give our audience an idea of why you feel that way.
Yeah, it shows a more accurate picture of your business. And for a business that's growing, it actually helps your valuation. If you're working off of a valuation that's a multiple of EBITDA or discretionary earnings. And the reason for this is simple. If you're a products-based business and you're growing, you're investing your profits back into new inventory and usually larger amounts of inventory. So the profits get eaten up. On accrual basis accounting, you don't recognize the expense of that larger inventory until it's actually sold. So the numbers end up being bigger. I mean, we have examples of businesses that under cash basis accounting would get a valuation of $400,000 to $450,000, and under accrual basis accounting can top out closer to $800,000 in valuation.
And that's just on recognition timing.
It's recognition timing, right? The $800,000 is the accurate valuation. The $400,000 to $450,000 is inaccurate, but it's based off of the best available data. Right, so you want to make sure that you have the right numbers, and accrual basis is the right way to do this. Again, you can file your taxes on cash basis. It's easy to flip back and forth, but you have to enter it correctly. And this client didn't have his numbers entered correctly.
Yeah, from my experience, most entrepreneurs that are running businesses under $1 million or $2 million in annual revenue do use cash basis, but they really should be using accrual basis for valuation purposes, for planning for the future, is what you're telling us here.
Yeah, and what I find is bookkeepers will often tell people to use cash basis because it's easy.
It's just easier, right? Lots less headaches for the bookkeeper.
It's a lot, yeah, I have a lot fewer headaches for the bookkeeper, and they'll tell you it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. I'll just come out and say it. They're wrong. It does matter. Accrual basis is the better way to file your books. It takes more work on their part. But take the time and hire somebody who's not afraid of entering books on accrual basis. So challenge one is he didn't have his numbers entered incorrectly. And challenge two, his bookkeeper was really not good. At the end of the year, his bookkeeper was making approximations for some of the key numbers. And so his taxes were really filed based off approximations and based off of this not accurate way of filing his books. We wanted to switch to accrual basis, and it was a good thing that we did so for this business. And we had a buyer in particular who looked at it and insisted that we get him accrual basis. One of the reasons for this is under cash basis accounting, you can't really get a sense for how your gross profit margins are trending over time. It's much harder to understand that. And under accrual basis, you see a really nice clean line. So you can understand that gross profit margin and how that's trending over time. So this buyer wanted accrual basis accounting.
Well, you're really telling our audience here, for business owners out there that are using cash basis, is that you may want to think about now, instead of the time it comes to sell your business and exit, think about putting together an accrual basis accounting system in advance, and it gives you a much cleaner picture of your business.
Yeah, and just so people understand, you know, the amount of time that we're looking for to get on accrual basis is at least 3 years, right? So going back and trying to do accounting 3 years ago is a challenge at best. It's not an easy exercise to go through. As this client discovered, right? He actually brought in a forensic specialist to go in and convert the books to accrual basis, or at least an approximation, a very good approximation of accrual basis that we felt good and knew would stand up to a due diligence inspection, which it did. But the problem came in when we were trying to get the funding for the deal. The buyer was very liquid, had plenty of money to be able to do a transaction. However, he wanted to leverage an SBA loan because why not, right? He had the money. Why not leverage the SBA and finance 90% of the transaction and let the business pay for itself? Well, SBA relies very heavily on tax returns, and the numbers that we were presenting in our profit and loss statements and balance sheets weren't matching up with the tax returns. So this is problem number two. How do we reconcile this difference, especially when some of the numbers were somewhat made up on the tax return? You know, we're just really approximations. SBA doesn't like approximations. The bank doesn't like approximations. They want to know everything is tidy. And so that came into round number two, where we really needed to focus on how do we create this discrepancy worksheet to be able to get everything to match up properly. And that added weeks upon weeks of time for us to develop this and then to explain it to the SBA lender and to underwriting and have that process work itself out. From the time that we received the offer on this business, which was in August, to the point where we got the commitment letter, to the point where we were getting to a close, was an exceedingly long period of time. We were looking at a total of 8 months to close the entire transaction. And a lot of it was because we had to create these reconciliation documents. We had to do all this back work that frankly should have been done, you know, years prior, and try to make everything work at that point. And then the hits just kept on coming with this deal, right? So we finally got numbers going and we got to a point where we felt good about things. And then there was a government shutdown. And so all SBA loans were on hold because SBA offices were backed up. And then, of course, they were backed up when the government reopened and we had to wait longer for that. And then there was a discovery about the buyer's past and some of his finances, which he had disclosed. It wasn't his fault, but the lender had missed initially. So they had to go back and reevaluate that and do appraisals on some property, which was not part of the original plan. And fast forward, you know, one other issue before we get to the closing portion, the valuation ended up coming in lighter than what we had on the table for an offer. And the reason it came in light is, once again, there was so much work that had to be done from the P&Ls that were actually accurate and real to the tax returns that the valuation company didn't feel confident putting the full valuation on the business. So we had a discrepancy in the offer price and what the bank was willing to lend. So we had to figure out a way to make up that delta.
So it looks like every time you turned around, there was another challenge and problem. And oftentimes in situations like this, people just get deal fatigue and walk away from the table. It's just too much hassle.
Yeah, absolutely. And everybody felt that way. I mean, everyone was fatigued on this deal. Everyone was, and it would have been very easy for people to lose their cool and to just go off on anybody in the process, you know, the lender or the buyer and the seller, or you know, even direct the anger towards me. Oftentimes that's where it gets directed, and look, that's fine. I'm okay with it if we can get the deal done. You know, and really it shouldn't have been any surprise at this point when we finally got to a point where we thought that we were going to be closing in April to have the bank come back and say, look, we just need one more thing, which is a very common thing with banks to hear, we need one more thing. And they wanted the financials that we were basing the valuation on to be officially reviewed by a CPA. Now, this was a huge problem because we were running up against the clock. If a certain amount of time expires from the time a commitment letter is issued to the time the deal is supposed to close, you have to start the process over again. And we were up against that within a week. We knew that we didn't have time to go find an accountant to do a CPA review of the documents and to get it done in a week. And then you can throw on top of that that this was Easter week. So the chances of us even finding people in the office was very, very remote. The forensic accountant who helped us with the entire situation fortunately had somebody in his office who was a CPA but had only foreign licensing. And we were able to get the bank to agree that was sufficient to be able to sign off on the documents. So everything was done. And when we ended up closing the deal, but you know, you look at a transaction like this where everything seems to go wrong, and you look at how did the buyer handle themselves? How did the seller handle themselves? How did all the advisors handle themselves? And the overwhelming theme was that the problems didn't wear people down to a point of frustration where they took that frustration out on each other. It was just another problem that needed to be solved. And everybody looked at it that way.
So I guess the big takeaway here then, what you're telling me is that when you run into problems, these are just issues that need to be worked through. And you got to look for creative solutions of what the issues are going to be resolved and how they're going to get resolved.
Yeah, the one thing that I love to explain to sellers when a deal starts to go sideways or there's a lot of friction, and buyers as well, when there's a lot of friction, is let's simplify this. At the end of the day, the seller wants to sell and the buyer wants to buy. If that's not true anymore, then we have a problem. But if that's the case, then the rest are details. And you just need to figure out the details at work. Sometimes it's complex. That doesn't mean that it's simple. But simplifying the problems and understanding the underlying motivation that the buyer wants to buy, the seller wants to sell, the rest are terms, can often help in looking at each problem as just that. It's a problem. It needs to be solved. It needs to be worked. But it can be worked and solved. And that's what everybody did. And everybody got a good deal at the end of the day. Everybody got the seller got paid. He's now working on his other businesses that he wanted to work on. The buyer is doing well with the business. It was a good transaction. And more importantly, they're still on friendly terms. It would be very easy for them to be upset with each other and raw, but they're not. They got through it together. So a testament to them.
Well, that's great. That's a good takeaway. Well, now let's move on maybe to a transaction you could share with us that talks a little bit more about transactions that worked out well and were a lot smoother and didn't have all these problems.
Yeah, I like these more than the problem ones, because these obviously fall into some of my favorite transactions of all time. And I think I'll start with what may have been one of my favorite transactions of all time. It was yet again another e-commerce business where the woman who owned this business, she had acquired it several years earlier. The business was selling a durable good plumbing-based product. So, something that would be installed once and then maybe installed again, replaced, 15, 20, 25, 30 years down the road. So not something where you're getting this recurring income. And it was in this, what I would call like a quote unquote boring niche. I love these niches because you don't have as much competition typically.
That's a good takeaway right there. Boring niches are great places to be sometimes, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. I guarantee you the people that make paperclips and erasers are probably doing pretty well, right? It's not the most exciting thing in the world, but there's demand for it. And usually not something that you think about when you're a kid. Like, I want to grow up and be in a boring niche, but it's a great place to make hay, especially if you love the aspect of business, optimizing a business. And this woman fit that description to a T. She was so good at optimizing what she bought. She bought a business that was very raw. It was a great product and great set of products. But the business needed a lot of work, and she was obsessive about details. So she went into this and immediately started to update the website, but not just update the website. She made sure that it made sense. And she put a lot of thought into every aspect of that and really made sure the customer experience was a beautiful experience. So everything was custom done. She had utilized multiple warehouses. They weren't her own. These were outsourced fulfillment warehouses, 3PLs. They were across the country. Well, she wanted to identify where was the best place to send inventory. So she had software built and modified that would make that process automatic for her and also help with her inventory management and, how much inventory should she be ordering, automate that process as well. From a customer service standpoint, she started to document the most common questions and created very clear-cut answers to everything so that not only was her customer service person able to really focus on maybe those edge case scenarios, but if that customer service person had to leave, replacing her wouldn't have been a difficult job at all because everything was very well documented. And every aspect of this business, she went in and was super detailed. That didn't stop when the time came for personal reasons that she decided to sell the business. I would say in all the years and the hundreds of transactions that I've been a party of, no one has ever been more detailed than this woman. Let me give you an example. When we list a business for sale, we have our clients fill out a very lengthy written interview, and it's a pain. They don't like it. I mean, it's like 75, 100 questions on average, and it takes time. So usually what you see to the questions would be, three, maybe four sentences at most. Well, she was submitting paragraphs to these questions. And she was adding diagrams and imagery to these questions so that there was just, there was meat on the bones. She submitted, without prompting, a diagram of her business so that I could see at a glance, this is my advertising arm and here are the pieces that you really need to know here. And this is my fulfillment chain right here. So you can understand what the value is over here and what you need to inspect. Everything about the business was documented, encapsulated, and put in a nice package so that when a buyer was looking at the business, they understood a few things. One, they understood the business. They could understand it and really digest it, but they also knew that they were buying a business that had an immense attention to detail. The result for her, in my opinion, was I think that she got a better valuation for the business. And the amount of demand that we saw from buyers was significant. We only approached 10 people with her business.
So what you did in this situation, when you say you only approached 10 people, was you really kind of created a private auction instead of going out to the general list that you have of people that are interested in buying businesses.
That's right. I mean, normally we would send something out to our list and it would generate hundreds of inquiries from potential buyers. So going out to just 10 people is pretty rare for us. We love to work on the volume play. But out of these 10 buyers, four of them were interested enough to make an offer, including, I want to say two, maybe three of them actually submitted physical LOIs. The other one just simply floated an offer out there and it wasn't going to work for us. But we were able to find a buyer relatively quickly within just a few days of approaching some buyers privately about our business. And that's a testament to the detail that she put in. And I think the big lesson to pull away from this is that documentation is not just about making your business easy to transfer. It's also about the perception that it creates for buyers.
When you say perception, are you talking about the perception of risk then?
Absolutely, right? When a buyer looks at your business, they don't know what they don't know. And so there's always going to be an accounting for that aspect. And if you have a very well-documented business, and if you're able to answer questions easily, and if you're able to volunteer information and show, look, I know my business so well, I have it diagrammed out for you. Well, this not only creates a perception, it's a reality in this case, that the buyer knew they were not buying a business where they were going to stumble into a big hole that the previous owner just completely ignored, or a big liability that was out there that the owner didn't know about, because this woman knew everything about her business, right? It reduces the perceived risk. And for a buyer, perceived risk is just as real as real risk. And that comes in the form of a discount. So the big lesson on this was that attention to detail and going above and beyond even what might be asked of you, it pays dividends. Like, it, not only will it make your life easier in the transition and the sale of your business, and I can't discount that enough because that's a difficult process, but it can actually put money in your pocket when it comes time to sell.
Well, the big takeaway, I guess, to kind of summarize then, is that the more documentation and organization you have really reduces risk, or perceived risk, or real risk, and less risk means a higher valuation. That's a good takeaway for our audience here that are listening. That risk is risk, whether it's perceived or not, and that has a dramatic impact on the valuation of a business. Well, let's move on to another and kind of our final story here. Mark, if you could just share one final transaction with us that went pretty well.
Yeah, this one is near and dear to my heart. I like this story very much because, you know, I'm a big believer that you sell your business when it makes sense to sell, right? And don't let anybody talk you into selling. Your business is yours, and you should sell it under the terms that make sense. So this is not everyone. Stories I've shared with you have been for e-commerce businesses. This is not an e-commerce business. This was a dating website with the focus on a particular religion as its angle, right? That was the type of member they were trying to attract. The owner had owned it for about 15 years when he had approached me. He was the founder. He was the operator for 15 years. He actually met his wife on his own site, which is a pretty cool story, right? You start a business, it sustains you, pays your bills, and You end up meeting your spouse. What a cool little story that is.
Yeah, that's very cool. So just for clarification, the dating website was for a specific church, right? Or faith?
That's correct. Yes. Yeah. They were trying to appeal to a certain religion or people that would identify as a certain religion. But after 15 years of running it, it was just time for him to move on. I mean, he was kind of done. He had been done for a while, you know, and the business was running on autopilot. So
generally what that means is when they've been done for a while and running on autopilot, that sales are generally in a decline.
Oftentimes they are. If sales aren't in decline, expenses are up, right? Because you're not paying attention to it. You're not optimizing it. Maybe you've hired people to replace yourself a little bit, and you let things become a little less efficient. And that was certainly the case with him, right? His revenue was down. His expenses were up. Particularly his advertising costs were up on this business, which was a little problematic and set off some warning signals for us that and for a potential buyer, like, you don't like to see advertising go up and revenue go down. that's a bad combination.
Not a good combination, is it?
right. So, you know, he came to me, I remember it was just a couple days after Christmas. And you know, we got on the phone and we were talking about his business, and he told me, he said, you know, I have an exit number in mind. He shared that with me, and you know, it was a nice, easy round number, which is oftentimes the case, where you get a number in your head and you say, that's what I want. And he wasn't anywhere near it. Honestly, he wasn't even halfway to the goal, maybe 40% of the way there to where he needed to be. And so the conversation changed, right? It didn't make sense for him to sell at that point because he just wouldn't get enough money from his business. And more importantly, you know, this discussion that I had with him, and I've had this with a number of people, is really a discussion as to whether or not that number is realistic. You know, the number that he had, let's just say for the sake of argument that the number was $1 million. Is that a realistic valuation for his business? And what's it going to take to get there? Now, my job isn't to tell people that their number is realistic or not. My job is to tell somebody, here's what you need to do to get this number, and then it's your job to tell me if you can do that, right? That's really more of the conversation. And so that was the conversation we had. And I explained to him, you know, the declining revenues, the declining subscriber numbers, especially for a dating site, are very disturbing, right? That's not the right trend. Your advertising costs are high, your staff costs are rising right now, and everything about this business is just kind of going in the wrong direction, where it really doesn't make it look like a viable business for the next 7 or 8 years. You know, why is your business declining? Why is advertising getting more expensive? And he didn't need me to continue on. He said, okay. He's like, that's really helpful. Let me work on it. Let's talk on a quarterly basis, and I'll give you some updates as to what's going on. And over the next 12 months, you know, we did talk every 3 months. He worked on the business and he started to reapply himself. One of the first things he did is he reduced some of his staff's hours and started taking on some of their work to reduce that expense. And this was a bit of a risk because in making the business more dependent on him, you know, that sets up a little bit of a transferability risk, but he really wanted to reduce the expense profile and be able to show what the business could actually do. Secondarily, he focused a lot on the advertising spend. What had happened is, you know, he was making money with the business being run as it was, but he just kind of ignored optimizing that advertising spend. He was relying a lot on Facebook advertising and AdWords. So he focused for several months on eliminating bad spend and really setting a budget for the advertising, which helped significantly. He was able to double down on the terms that were doing really well and remove some of the terms that he was literally just throwing money away on. Next, he ended up being more aggressive on some of his press opportunities. He got out in front of the press a lot more, and that helped quite a bit. Obviously, that's kind of a grunt work type project, but it was very effective in growing the revenues without adding anything to the advertising costs. And finally, he found and worked several partnerships with publications and podcasts to have a revenue sharing basis partnership where they were promoting his product on a revenue sharing basis, which is obviously very cash flow friendly for him. And that made a big difference over the course of the next year, where his valuation rapidly went from being about 40% of the goal, 40% of the way to goal, to about maybe 70 to 80% of the way to his ultimate goal of where he wanted to sell the business. After 12 months, we got to that, and we had explained to him where he was valuation wise, and he decided on his own at that point that it was worth selling. That getting that last 20% was going to take more work than he wanted to be able to put into the business for the next year. And so we ended up getting it sold and getting it sold for about 80% of the way to his goal, which was definitely a win for the business. There's a lot of lessons, I think, here to take away, a lot of things to take away from this. One, obviously, is understanding the timing of the sale. And secondly, to understand that, we hear oftentimes from business owners when they hear the valuation and they say, oh, my business is worth more than that. And I get it. Oftentimes it is, but the value is kind of nascent. It's kind of locked and needs to be unlocked in a way. And the analogy I would give would be a house, right? You might be in a neighborhood. You might have a house in a neighborhood where the average home price is $1 million. But if you've got dingy paint, dirty carpets, cracked walls, bad electrical in your house, you're not going to get the same market value as your neighbors. But if you go in there and slap on some new paint and replace those carpets and fix up the electrical and do all the things that you need to do, you can show potential buyers what the business is actually worth and get what it's actually worth. And the same thing holds true with the business, right? His business was much more valuable than what his initial valuation came in at, but none of the metrics and none of the data was supporting it. He needed to get it to that point, which is what he did and was able to do successfully. So took some time, took a year for him to get there, but some diligent work got him there.
Well, I guess you could say, and it's kind of a truism, an adage, that you have a plan and you work your plan and you position, in this case, your business for sale at some point in time by working that plan and having a path.
My business partner says, don't decide to sell, plan to sell. And he's absolutely right. Putting that planning in makes a big difference in the amount that the terms and the type of deal that you get when you do sell.
Well, that's cool. I think that's got a good business partner there. Deciding and planning. That's cool. All right. Well, this has been great. I think there's some good takeaways that we've learned here. Our audience should get out their pencil and jot some of these down. If someone wanted to reach out and get a hold of you, how would they do that?
They can find us at quietlightbrokerage.com. And anyone is welcome to email me directly. Mark, that's Mark with a K, M-A-R-K, at quietlightbrokerage.com is the best way to reach us.
You can also go to our website, businessexitstories.com, and we'll have that in our show notes, and you can reach Mark through our website or reach out to him directly. Well, this has been great, Mark. I appreciate the time you've taken here today to share a little bit of your experience, some of your stories, and some of the takeaways that we've learned here today. And so until next time on Business Exit Stories, we'll see you then.
Join us in our next episode when our guests will share more stories of how entrepreneurs, founders, and business owners have exited their businesses and learn about what to avoid and what you need to do to successfully position your business for a successful exit. If you enjoyed this podcast, take a minute to give us a rating on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts so aspiring entrepreneurs everywhere can find us. If you wish to reach out to any of our guests, please visit our website at www.businessexitstories.com, where you can find more information. Join us next time for more Business Exit Stories.